You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Wednesday, March 29th, 2023. On today's episode, we're going to have a spoiler-filled conversation about The Mandalorian, Chapter 21, The Pirate. This is Slash Film Editorial Director Peter Serretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film Editor Brett Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And Star Wars expert Brian Young.
I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, before we get into this week's discussion, let's start with feedback, which I'm going to start off with the weekly Peter Got Something Wrong admission. Last week I said that Carl Weathers made his Mandalorian directorial debut with last week's episode, Chapter 20, but he previously directed an episode of Season 2, so I don't know why I said that, because I knew that, and I looked at the IMDb while I was doing the research for the episode. I think I was just going crazy, so I apologize. He has directed two episodes of Mandalorian. We got some emails. Let's read the emails. Okay, first one is more of a Star Wars specific email. It's from Manuel. He writes in, "One thing that always bothered me with Star Wars movies and TV shows alike are planets always seem to be one city, basically. In the case of Navarro, about 30 people, but fans never seem to be bothered by this." So he wanted to hear our thoughts on that. Brian, I'm sure you have some thoughts on the city-like nature of the planets in Star Wars.
I think this is something that's really part and parcel what George Lucas was doing, just with the motifs and things he was working with originally. But you'll notice that, like, Tatooine has a whole bunch of cities now. You just have a hard time telling them apart. Or Coruscant is just one entirely big city, or whatever. Like, I think Star Wars is not trying for any sort of realism or accuracy as far as the science or the biomes of planets are concerned, which is why you get a planet that's entirely a forest or a planet that's entirely a ball of snow. None of it makes any sense, actually, but that's just the way Star Wars works, because it's a visual shorthand for what's going on. So that's what you get with Star Wars.
You know, I know this wasn't the question, but since you brought it up, Brian, I wanted to ask you, are there planets in Star Wars that have multiple environments, like different types of environments? Or,
well, I mean, going back to Tatooine, right? Like, there's sand and there's rocks. That's two different sort of
but is there a planet that has like a rainforest and also a desert?
I don't think so. I think the closest we might come to is like Naboo or Kashyyyk, where they have like ocean and forest, or like underwater cities and surface cities. You know what I mean? I think that's about as diverse as the cultures in Star Wars planets get. You know, Coruscant, the closest we get to like anything different than a city is just the top of that mountain in Monument Plaza.
Brad, do you have any thoughts on the one city Star Wars planets?
I mean, I think the city thing is probably a little less irksome than the you know, environment thing, because like, of course, like we're only ever going to see a small part of a given planet. You know, I mean, we can't visit all the different places on a planet. We know how big a planet is because we know how big Earth is. So, you know, it's fine if we only go to certain locations. But, you know, and like Brian said, too, we're starting to see other cities on Tatooine, even though they look similar. But like, the weirder thing is definitely having planets just represented by one entire, you know, environment, like Hoth being snow and Dagobah being a swamp and all that jazz.
The other thing that's interesting, I saw someone on my Twitter timeline. They were visiting Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, and they said, "I'm back in Batuu." And I was like, "That's a weird thing to say. Like, I would never say I'm back in Earth. I'm back in Tatooine."
Yeah, I think it's probably just because, like,
I know.
Yeah, Batuu feels like a place, you know, that you go to because it's in Disneyland rather than being, you know, the planet you're on.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Okay, this other question came to us from two separate people, had the same theory. Cade in Iowa and Aaron in Lancashire, UK. They both had the same thought. I'm going to read Aaron's email because it's more concise, I think. It says, big fan of the spoiler discussions. I listen to every one of them, much to my children's chagrin. I just had a thought with regards to Grogu's escape from Coruscant. Brian wrote up this great theory about Jar Jar Binks. I love this theory. However, I did have another thought. A key part of Brian's theory was that Jar Jar and Padme are the only two people that we've come across from Naboo with the means to help in this way, and that they were on Coruscant at the time. Padme was discounted for some good reasons, but there is another. Could
if he says Captain Typho?
No, he's not okay. Saying that. This one might even be more ridiculous, Brian. So hold on.
Okay.
Could Sheev Palpatine, former Naboo senator, be behind the escape? It's feasible to me that most of the Jedi would not be aware that Palpatine's betrayal or that he was behind Order 66. It's conceivable that Kelrin Beck might have reached out to him for help, and seeing the opportunity to ensnare some of this Jedi, Palpatine offers him the ship. Will we see in the next flashback that Beck has been betrayed by the person he thought was helping him? This would also put Grogu in the Empire's hands very early. It would explain how, when we meet him in the first episode of The Mandalorian, the Empire are aware of his existence and are actively hunting him. It would stand to reason that the Empire had possession of him before he was either stolen or escaped, hence why they enlisted Din to get him back. So this is an interesting theory that did not even come into my mind. Brian, what do you think?
So I think there's two things at play here. One, I would say never say never. If they want to sort of retcon or twist themselves into a pretzel to make this the case, I'm sure they can. But there's two major factors that I think make it too much of a stretch. One is that the Jedi Council and the Jedi in general were very wary of the Chancellor, and that was the mission Mace Windu and the rest of the Council had gone on to go, like, arrest him. So why Kelleran and Beck would be like, hey, I know Mace Windu was on his way to arrest you. You know, but help me. The other thing is that you'll notice that Palpatine, after he ascends to the chancellorship, no longer has Naboo guards or any of that stuff around him. It's always the Imperial Royal Guards or clones that are sort of, or stormtroopers even, are around him, or the Senate guards, the blue-robed Senate guards. So the visual cues that we have from Star Wars, like, I think they're really smart in how they use visual language and costumes and things to tell stories of cultures that, if we were meant to believe that it was possibly Palpatine, I think they would have used the blue Senate guards and we would have been led easier down that path. The other one I was thinking as I was thinking about it was Captain Typho, because Captain Typho would have access to all of those things. But he felt very much in the dark about everything the same way Padme was and hadn't learned anything else, based in Revenge of the Sith. So I discarded him as well. So I think they could twist the knots around to make Palpatine work, but I still think Jar Jar is our best bet.
I feel like if it's Jar Jar, we're not going to find that out. It's not going to be revealed. And I feel like also if it was Typho, we wouldn't, like, that's not interesting enough. Palpatine's interesting, but Brad, is it too ridiculous?
I mean, it's maybe not ridiculous if you think about the fact that, like, there's probably a part of this that is, like, setting up the whole concept of cloning and things like that for Palpatine to come back in the sequel trilogy. So, like, if they're, you know, using Pershing to, you know, deal with clone development by the Empire and things like that, you know, it could stand to reason that Palpatine maybe saw a benefit in using somebody like, you know, Grogu or something like that, because he knew like what he could do with, you know, a species and a youngling who maybe, you know, had promise of being a powerful Jedi. So yeah, it's I think it's probably not likely, but it's certainly not impossible.
Yeah, I wouldn't be mad at it. Although, are we under the agreement that we're going to see more of this flashback and we're going to see more of what happened to Grogu before he met Mando?
I think it's certainly possible.
Well, of course it's possible. Brian always says like anything's possible. They could, but like, well, Brian, what do you think? Like, do you think it's going to happen?
I think if Jon Favreau is really talking about taking the show indefinitely, and he just sent Jar Jar, or the actor behind Jar Jar, on an adventure with Grogu, it's very possible that. Well, no, I mean, like,
yeah.
All he did was take him to hyperspace here, and is Grogu. We've got three more episodes of this season. I don't see them going back to that storyline this season, but then again, I didn't see them going there in the first place. But if they just dole out little pieces of that adventure over the next, you know, few seasons or chapters or whatever, they could milk that as long as they wanted to. I mean, they showed us literally like 12 minutes of their partnership.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's go into our brief thoughts on this episode, The Pirate. Brad, let's start with you. What were your thoughts on this episode?
I thought it was a pretty solid episode. Some good Star Wars action, some nice pirate battling. I like that they actually made the pirate's ship similar to that of a pirate ship, with the gunner stations kind of being like cannons on actual pirate ships. You know, the siege on Navarro was pretty cool, seeing the Mandalorians come together. And there was a couple, you know, unexpected moments that I didn't see, you know, actually happening that came about here. So, yeah, overall, I think a pretty good episode of The Mandalorian. Although I will say this isn't necessarily a detriment to the series, but like it feels a little bit odd that for a show that was set up to be squarely focused on Din Djarin, that this season more so seems to be about the Mandalorians at large and the redemption arc of Bo-Katan. And it kind of feels like this is becoming less The Mandalorian and more here's a general Star Wars sequel series that we have, you know, stealthily introduced by way of a show that is still called The Mandalorian.
They could just add an S to the title, though.
But I would even argue
James Cameron, easy.
I would even argue, you know, every episode of this podcast, I ask Brian about the title of the chapter. And I would even argue that the title of this series, The Mandalorian, could be about the Mandalorian people and not just about this one Mandalorian. Like it could have multiple meanings, just like the chapters.
No, I've thought about that too. And like, it's that's a fine excuse, but it still doesn't change the fact that it feels like Din Djarin is starting to be a little overshadowed as a character by, you know, the larger world that he's in.
Yeah. It also seems like a little weird that it's almost like he's becoming a side character. Not that like he's not leading the charge. There's other people leading the charge. Yeah, I do see that. Brian, what are your thoughts on this episode?
I thought this episode was absurdly silly in some of my favorite ways. It balanced that Flash Gordon-ness. I don't think we've had such a Flash Gordon silly old serial episode like this in quite a while. And it nourished that part of me, but it didn't outweigh the gravitas of the episode and like the important things that happened. And yeah, like the action was just really cool. And we learned more and we advanced the story and there were really cool things that I'm sure we're going to talk about over the course of this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? My issue with this season so far is that it's been kind of directionless. Like when we started off this season, it almost seemed like they painted themselves in such a corner with the season two finale of Mandalorian, with Grogu going off with Luke Skywalker, that it was almost like they had to reboot this series. And with the first couple episodes, you still didn't know, like, usually in a movie you have like, you know, or even a TV show, you have the inciting incident that kind of like lays the path of like, this is the struggle, this is what the hero needs to get to, and at the end of the, you know, the season or this movie, this is the battle that's, you know, he's going to have to overcome these obstacles, and he's going to have this confrontation with this person to accomplish this thing that was set up at the beginning. And I feel like this season of The Mandalorian has been kind of directionless in establishing exactly what those things are, other than we've had vague things of like, I guess maybe reuniting the Mandalorian, but it didn't really like seem, I don't know, so I guess that's my one criticism on the writing of this season. Like, we could have had this Moff Gideon thing happen, kind of, even though it was spoken about in previous episodes of the possibility that he had escaped or whatever, like, maybe set that up earlier, maybe, I don't know, I don't know how you'd fix it, but I guess that's my problem. It's also my problem with, like, the current, you know, three phases of the MCU, is we kind of know where it's going to end up, but we don't. It kind of seems to be lacking an obvious direction.
But I think that's actually one of the interesting things about Carson Teva in this episode, because he's going like, these things are all connected, and Tim Meadows is like, meh. And I think that there's like, I think we're supposed to be Carson Teva, the super fans, going, all this stuff's connected, and it is going to come and join all those things together, which makes Carson Teva like a really good audience stand-in for us, because we see how all this stuff is connecting, but the New Republic is reticent to believe it.
Yeah, that was what I was actually leading up to, and I forgot my point of that whole thing, so thank you, Brian. But my point was, this episode, the threads kind of feel like they're actually finally coming together, and we're kind of seeing the grand plan that was being laid out, but it really felt like it took five episodes to get here, if that makes sense. So I enjoyed it. I thought the visuals in this episode were some of the best of the season. And I would probably, I don't know, I almost want to credit that to director Peter Ramsey, who, you know, probably best known as one of the directors of Into the Spider-Verse. But he started as a storyboard artist on Nightmare on Elm Street, Dream Child. He's worked as a storyboard artist for 20 years on some huge movies, and he eventually made his way into animation as the director of Rise of the Guardians at DreamWorks, and he recently also did Lost Dolly on Netflix. But this is his live action directorial debut, I think, unless someone emails me and proves me wrong, and I have to apologize next week. So I wanted to ask you guys thoughts on Ramsey as a director here.
Seems like I've got some solid work.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, you know, if we're going to go back, to the Bryce Dallas Howard debate, you know, like, it seems like there were some really great people on his crew too.
Yes. Listen, I'm not credit. I'm just saying, like, it seemed to me that there was like some fantastic visuals in this episode, more so than like more than the rest of the season. I'm wondering if, I guess it's a question. I'm not trying to credit him, because there's a fantastic crew backing up.
I'm just kidding that it was, yeah. It's whenever we have these conversations and it's a dude, not us specifically, but other places, when it's a dude, it's always just like, yeah, he did great. But when it's Bryce Dallas Howard, everybody's like, but look at the team she had behind
her. I know.
I think the story gave him the visuals, though, right? Like, having Mandalorians drop out of that ship and land down in the battle with pirates, you know, there hasn't been stuff like that much yet, where they're fighting on Mos. We had, like, the episode with the pterosaur, where they fought that, and that had some of those elements, but not at this scale. So I think the scale of the story is what lent itself to give him the opportunity to have some of those the coolest visuals we've seen this season.
Yeah, but I'd bring it back to the one moment that Brad brought up, like the people going into the gunner seats on that pirate ship. That could have just been guns poking out of the ship and then firing. Do you know what I mean? Like, but you didn't have to have them running to the thing and getting into those pods. And like, and again, I don't think Peter Ramsey designed, like, you know, it's one of the art crew that designed those pods and stuff like that. But it was so cool.
Yeah, no, it was cool. I loved how much they leaned into the pirate stuff, down to the Mr. Smee Ugnaught and the jaunty pirate treatment of the main theme.
For sure. I also forgot to say, if you have some feedback for us, or you have a theory, you have something you want us to read on the podcast, you can send it to us at peter@toshlam.com. I forgot to say that after our feedback section. But let's get into, actually, before we get into the main episode, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Okay, let's get into our breakdown. I before we get into the breakdown, I should also mention that this episode has two directors of photography, which is unusual. David Klein, who's worked on a lot of Mandalorian episodes, and then Paul Hugin, who has worked on Book of Boba Fett and Obi-Wan Kenobi. I don't know the reasoning for that. I'm guessing Klein had something going on and they needed someone to come in, but that's just speculation on my part. But I thought it was worth noting because you don't usually see two directors of photography. So this is one of those previously ons that kind of spoils some of what happens in the episode. Like when I watched the previously on, I was like, oh, okay. So we're either going to see Moff Gideon or learn about his escape in this episode, and the pirate situation is going to come to a head. And both of those were true. So,
yeah, but I've been telling you that since episode one, though.
Yes. Okay. So we begin on Navarro, where they are sure to show this establishing shot of the IG-11 statue in the square, and it's still missing all the droid pieces that Mando had removed and recovered. So I wanted to ask you guys, do you think we're going to come back to this? Is IG-11 rising from the dead still a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, he's still got the parts, and I'm sure that, you know, at some point maybe he'll encounter what he needs to maybe try to make it work. But, you know, will we see him come back before the end of the season? Maybe, because maybe they can use him in order, like, to reclaim Mandalore or in their fight against the Empire. But, you know, I don't know.
So one thing I've been thinking about as far as this goes, too, with Jon Favreau feeling very confident he has carte blanche to just kind of do this series until he gets tired of it. You'll notice in long runs of comic book series, right? Like, if you go back and read, like, Walt Simonson's run on Thor, there is stuff that he plants seeds for 40 issues before it actually pays off. And so if Jon Favreau is feeling comfortable that he can do this show from now until Doomsday, he could very well just be planting seeds for stuff he might not need to pull out of the ground for 2, 3, 4, 5 seasons.
I don't know. It kind of seems like a setup that's meant for this season to pay off later in the season, but I don't know. Maybe I could be wrong. There's definitely been some stuff that they've set up in season one that didn't pay off until season two. So,
yeah, it's anybody's guess.
Yeah.
Which is actually something I appreciate about the storytelling, right? Where we could say, like, oh, that didn't wrap up. We'll probably get something in the next season. And to leave some of those questions out there is not the worst thing.
Yeah. But I will say that establishing shot of showing the half statue in the middle of the square, to me, is kind of like, not just like, oh, it's cool imagery, but to me reads as like, oh, this is, you know, something that should also, you know, remember that thing that might come back later. Do you know what I mean? It seems like good storytelling and not just cool imagery to me, but I could be wrong. So what were you gonna say?
I could be wrong too. I could be wrong too. I just,
yeah. Okay, so High Magistrate Greef Karga is busy doing some of the city planning when Pirate King Gorian Shard's ship enters the city's airspace. And Greef noticed that the Corsair looked familiar.
The Corsair, yeah.
Corsair? What is a Corsair? Yeah.
So it's just a kind of ship. Corsairs are it's pirating terms too, right? Like, they would call very fast ships corsairs and things like that. A corsair is also another name for a pirate ship. This dates back to like the 16th century.
Yeah.
a pirate corsair is just a thing.
And I looked this up on Wikipedia, and the first time it was mentioned in Star Wars was in 1995 book Tales from the Mos Eisley Cantina. So it's been something in Star Wars lore for some time. Shard is upset about his pirate crew being gunned down on Navarro, but Karga says it was his pirate crew's fault because they shot first. Did everyone else's eyes roll when this line was spoken?
No, I liked it.
You did?
Yeah.
I didn't. What about it would be eye rolling?
It seems like it's a reference to the whole, you know.
Yeah, of course it is. That's what makes it fun.
I guess I didn't even think about that until you said that.
Oh, like, really?
Okay.
Yeah, that was the first thing I thought of.
I have tried really hard to stay out of the whole Han shot first debate because, like, I don't care and I don't think it changes the story point. So it's just never the first thing I think about.
Oh, I don't care about who shot first. Like, that whole debate is just stupid to me. Like, it's just people mad about what was changed in the special editions. Not to put down anybody out there that really has a feeling about that. But, like, I don't know, I just don't think, like Brian says, I don't think it changes the story in any way. I think what I'm saying here, Brian, is it felt like just like, oh, let's throw in a reference just to throw in a reference kind of thing.
I mean, I don't think so because, like, I feel like that, like, he was going to say something to that effect anyway. And so kind of saying it like that and making it that, like, an amusing, you know, nod for those who know, then I think is perfectly fine.
Fair enough.
It's similar to the to Dr. Pershing saying it's a trap to Amon Calamari in the a couple episodes ago.
Yeah. Okay. So with Moff Gideon gone and Navarro being an independent world, they lack protection and Shard won't fall for Karga's bluffs. Shard's ship takes aim on the city and survivors flee the city, but many are meeting their end in this sequence. And then we cut to the chapter title for chapter 21. It is The Pirate. And Brian, every episode I ask you to impress us with a possible double meaning of a title, but this time I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing it. I don't think you're going to impress us this time.
I mean, don't you think that Greef Karga is something of a pirate?
He was. Not
and that's
anymore.
The reputation. That's the reputation that the pirates are dealing with him now. So they're treating him like he is a pirate also still. Mm.
And I guess maybe they did raid Moff Gideon for the pirates. I don't think there's anything here, Brian.
I don't think there's a whole lot either, but I did get the idea that there was a possibility that Greef Karga could have been mentioned in that.
For sure. Okay, so a Y-Wing lands on the sandy beach. It's a New Republic outpost. Do we know where this is? Do we know where... Has this been established before?
So, Carson Teva's stationed in a place called Adelphi. And they're the Adelphi Rangers. He mentions that in the episode.
Oh, okay. I missed that. I think that was also mentioned earlier in the season, too.
Yeah, yeah. And this whole environment reminds me of the... of just the officers... club in MASH, but Star Wars.
Oh, it reminded me of that bar from Top Gun.
I like MASH better.
You like MASH better?
Or, yeah, no, it's fine.
Have you seen All Mankind? There was like this bar that they would all commiserate in. I feel like it's kind of...
But I think the Dave Filoni cameo lends more credence to the MASH thing just because his name is Trapper Wolf,
okay.
Which is a reference to Trapper John.
What were you gonna say, Brad?
Oh no, nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. So if you missed it, Dave Filoni, Rick Famuyiwa, and Deborah Chow reprise their roles as pilots in New Republic at this bar. It's actually kind of not obvious in the scene. So I think people probably might miss it because they're kind of blurry and in the foreground. But cool to see. And a cameo that you might have missed, not a cameo, but like a returning Mandalorian actor that you might have missed. There was a Snaggletooth bartender that serves Carson Teva, and that bartender is played by Misty Rojas, who played the Quill in season one, Frog Lady in season two, and she played one of the pirates in this season. And now she's the bartender. So she's what's the word I'm looking for? She's a
little person.
No, what? No, I was gonna say
a jack of all trades.
Yes, that's the words I was looking for, Brian.
Oh, it's is she not a little person? Because it seems
She definitely is a little person, but that wasn't the words I was looking for.
Oh, I just wasn't sure if you knew of like the proper like way to reference.
No,
that.
No. I was just saying she was a jack of all trades. That's what I was looking for.
You can feel free to take that part out if you want to.
I think it's funny. Okay. Teva receives a message from Greef Karga requesting help, and the message was sent via disk transmission, which got me thinking, how do holo messages work? Because sometimes we see two-way live communication, and sometimes we see it's a recorded one-way message, like the message that Princess Leia records to R2 in New Hope. I know Brian is going to say that the answer is that whatever the story needs is how they do it. But Brian, I wanted to ask you, what is there actual logic to how in the Star Wars galaxy things work about like two-way transmissions versus one-way transmissions?
So there are, and if you're reading the High Republic really kind of gets into that a lot, where there's these communications buoys that you can shoot down and disrupt communications of places. It gets better over the years, but the further out into the Outer Rim you get, the more difficult it is to get those messages out. If you remember in Phantom Menace, Maul had C.O. Bibble send that message out, and it was just one of those recorded messages just to find a connection trace. And that's because he doesn't know where the object of the message is going to go. So they just blast it everywhere and they can pull that frequency down. And then when they finally do watch the message, then they can trace them. You know what I mean? So there is a certain logic to the way they do some of those broadcasted one-way transmissions, the two-way transmissions, which are probably more expensive, and then messages like this that are more rare and direct if you've got some way to get that out there.
Yeah. I was just like wondering, why doesn't Greef Karga just like phone him and get like access to him immediately? Why in this situation?
Maybe the pirates had destroyed the communications buoys. Maybe they're blocking signals. Yeah. That's something that's pretty normal for pirates to do. You know what I mean?
For sure. Okay, so holy crap, guys. Zeb from Star Wars Rebels sits down next to him. I got to admit, at first I was like, oh, look, it's a Lasat, like Zeb from Star Wars Rebels. And then he started talking, and I was like, wait, is that Steve Blum? Is that Zeb? I wanted to get what your reaction was to that,
Brian. Mine was actually exactly yours. Like, ooh, a Lasat. Wait, is that Steve Blum? No, that can't be Zeb. I guess it's Zeb.
Brad, what was your reaction?
Yeah, exactly the same. I was like, oh, cool. They just brought one of these things in here. And, you know, now we'll have the species officially brought into live action. And then, you know, maybe we'll get Zeb in the future. And then it's like, oh, crap, that's actually him.
So do you think this is just a fun cameo, or do you think this is a setup? It seems clear to me that, like, if we were going to get the Rangers of the New Republic, that maybe Zeb would have been involved in that show.
I think that's safe to say. And I also think that, like, this means that he's got to be making an appearance, you know, likely in the Ahsoka series, because, like, you're not going to do a character like this, which is clearly, you know, an expensive endeavor. And just use him for like this quick appearance that is not really significant. So like they're definitely going to have to bring him back in some capacity.
Yeah, that's something that's really the Dave Filoni and his team in the animated world really leaned on that whole thing where it's like, let's pay to build the assets that are going to save us money down the road so we can use them a ton. And this Zeb is so complicated. I can't imagine them going like, you know what we should blow a whole bunch of money on? Zeb right here. Because why would they, like, they would just, if they wanted a cameo, they'd make a cameo. But Zeb is here for a reason, I'm assuming.
I also, so what do you guys think about how he's created? To me, I think that he's mostly practical with a CG enhanced face.
That's what I think too. I don't know anything.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but to me, the texture of like the beard and like the rest of the body and everything around the moving parts of his face looked way too realistic to feel like it was a completely CG character. But I think that they did use visual effects to like smooth out what was probably a practical face creation.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was all CG too.
You know, that also brings up another thing. It's like, maybe not only were they putting him in here for budgetary reasons of being able to develop this character to see how he would look before they do Ahsoka, but maybe like they needed to try that out. Maybe they were like not sure, like, oh, what would work? CG, live action prosthetic augmented with CG, and like being able to do it here before they get on set for Ahsoka means that they have more figured out before they actually started filming Ahsoka.
I think that's all pretty logical. I think the bigger question for me is less how they did it and like why Zeb is there in that position at this point in the timeline. You know what I mean? Is this before or after the epilogue in Rebels? Did he just decide like, well, I'm just going to join the New Republic? Like, he's in a pretty straight up like New Republic fighter uniform. Much like we'd see Poe Dameron in the first season of Resistance when he was still sort of moonlighting between the two, the Resistance and the New Republic military. Or no, that Kaz was wearing when Kaz was in the New Republic military. So why would he have made this jump into the New Republic? I don't know. And since we have so many confirmed Rebels characters in Ahsoka, why wouldn't he be there now?
Yeah. And he's also wearing blue, which I don't think is... Have we seen the blue color, the jumpsuit before?
Not in live action. Like I said, Kaz in the Resistance wore one. All of the New Republic officers on Star Wars Resistance, all the New Republic pilots wore the blue. And I think that's why they call him... That's why they call Carson Teva Blue Boy, is because those are the New Republic colors.
Wasn't there a blue pilot suit in Rogue One?
Yes. General Antok Merrick wore a blue suit, and he was Blue Squadron, though. So it was just that Ryan, was they
how
were...
do you pull out that name out of nowhere?
He got an action figure.
I don't know if I have maybe I have a General Merrick action figure, but
I didn't mean that you had the action figure. I just meant like he's been given an action figure, so like the name is probably like a little more prevalent out there.
Just obsessed with him in early viewings of Rogue One because he was just such a cool like side character. Like,
he's got a great mustache too.
Yeah, he had a great mustache, a great smile, and his sacrifice hit hard.
I'm just amazed that you were able to pull that out without looking it up or anything.
This is why you have me here, though.
Yes. So Teva wants to forward the message to Coruscant, but Zeb says they haven't returned to dispatch in weeks. And, what's going on at the Capitol? I know Zeb says that they're swamped. Although when he shows up there later, it didn't look like they were that swamped, but whatever.
Reminder, I was going to ask you, Coruscant's not the Capitol.
What is the capital?
Chandrila, Mon Mothma's homeworld.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right. Okay, sorry, not the capital. Yes. So I guess what I'm asking here is I wonder if anything big is going on or if they just have their hands full trying to restore peace and galaxy. Like, what do you think is going on that like they're so behind on everything?
I think the episode with Dr. Pershing kind of gave us a window into that in that there's two things going on. There's the fact that they're still disassembling all of the Imperial stuff and having to catalog it all, and the Empire was vast, but also the fact that they've already begun disassembling the Alliance fleet.
Yeah.
Right. So like if you imagine the New Republic at 100% could maybe keep up with all of this stuff, but they draw that down to 10% of that size, they're going to have a really difficult time keeping up with all of that.
Makes sense. So Tava says they can't ignore him in person, so he's going to go to the Capitol and request that they intervene. And he goes there. He enters this Art Deco building. Have we seen this building before, Ryan?
If we have, it would have been in the last episode where we went to Coruscant. I didn't recognize it right off the bat.
So Tava meets with Colonel Tuttle,
with as much Brazil as they've been going hard on in these Coruscant episodes, I can't imagine that's not a Brazil reference.
But he's played by an SNL legend, and on this podcast we have a big fan of SNL. So Brad, tell us about this actor.
Tim Meadows. He was a cast member who was mostly prominent in the 90s, probably best known for playing the ladies' man, which was a character that also got his own movie. And he's been a longtime character actor. He's appeared in stuff like Mean Girls. He's also pretty close with Andy Samberg and the Lonely Island crew. So you've seen him in things like Pop Star. He was also in Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. He's been all over the place. He's a fun actor.
Seems like a weird choice to play this kind of like straight-laced New Republic character, though.
Yeah, I think that just like, I don't know if it's Favreau or Filoni or if it's their casting director, but like somebody has a proclivity for casting comedians in these supporting roles, because we have Amy Sedaris, we've had Horatio Sanz, we've had Bill Burr. We've just had like an interesting assembly of comedians come into the Star Wars universe in these bit parts.
I think that's Favreau. If you look back at his like even feature films, he did that a bunch, casting like weird.
I wonder how much of it is.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Production sort of limitations as well, because they're shooting in LA. And it's like, who could we get for cheap to come in for a day? And the comedian set tends to stick around LA or New York, right? Mm. Whereas a lot of the actors you'd normally, you know, like they're not doing this on Andor, but they're shooting Andor in London. So you get that group of, you know, British actors that are on Game of Thrones and Chernobyl and stuff like that.
I mean, that's like, true as well.
Because of where the geography of where they're shooting it, this is just the pool of people they have around to come and be a day player.
But I have a feeling that this is going to be more than a day player. I feel like we're going to see more of this character in the future.
I hope so.
Yeah, because Tuttle watches 5 seconds of that message. He's got the gist of it. It's so funny. It's like so important. Like this like planet is being destroyed. And he's like, oh, I got the gist of it. And then they're interrupted by Amnesty Officer G68, who is the former Imperial that set up Pershing a couple of episodes ago. She says that Navarro is not a member planet of the New Republic, and Tuttle says that they have a backlog of member planet requests to get through before they could get to that. So Tava thinks that Gideon and the Imperial Resurgence might be connected to this pirate trying to take over Navarro, and Tuttle thinks it's a big leap to make. So I wanted to ask you guys, Brad, what do you think? Do you think there is something connected to here of like them, that the Gorian Shard trying to take over Navarro and it being related to Gideon or possibly Thrawn or anything we've speculated before?
I don't think that it's necessarily as nefarious as like everything being connected, but I think that he'll be proven right inadvertently, probably, because what's happening on Navarro is tied to the Mandalorians, and the Mandalorians have ties to what's going on with Moff Gideon. And so like there's, I think maybe it's more indirect than completely direct. But then again, the very end of this episode would seem to imply that maybe there is something more, you know, there than meets the eye. So he could end up being more right. But currently, I don't think that there's necessarily any evidence of it. So, but we'll probably find out more about that in the next episode. Hey, well, hey, hey, hey.
Well, G68 suggests that we should let Navarro suffer and force them to become signatories. This leads to a heated discussion between Tiva and G68. Brian, I have a feeling you have some thoughts on this whole.
She's this character this season so far that I just love to hate. After she sold out Pershing and then walked in that smug arrogance, like, well, maybe they need to learn. Like, she's obviously, like, with the way they shot her watching Tiva come in, there was recognition there. She knew where his district was, and she knew that that was where Gideon was operating. That I think they're just really playing up the fact that she's pulling whatever strings she can on Coruscant and wherever else to enact Gideon's wishes. And it is gross. It's gross in the best ways.
Yeah, I like what they're doing with these series of kind of showing how the New Republic weren't the, you know, even though they were obviously much better than the Empire, like they're repeating a lot of the same mistakes. They're like, oh no, it also is that they don't have as many people to be able to handle what, you know, these new responsibilities. But it's just interesting that like she could say that and that could be like, oh yeah, yeah, they should join. You know, it's that the line of thinking that was the Empire could be the line of thinking that is now the New Republic of they need to learn the lesson. So, okay. So Tiva thinks something is going on, and when it becomes big enough for them to act, it'll be too late. Do you think we're supposed to think that this is the rise of the First Order? Or something smaller than that. No,
I think that the First Order is off in the unknown regions, and I'm not sure Gideon or Thrawn have anything to do with them.
You don't think it'll eventually tie together?
I think it could. I think there's more stuff that's tying into the First Order on Bad Batch than there is here on Mandalorian.
Yeah, that makes sense. One thing I forgot to ask when Zeb showed up is it's interesting that some of these actors from the animated shows that they bring into live action are reprising their role, like the voice actors are reprising their roles. And then others are completely recast, like Rosario Dawson as Ahsoka. So I wanted to hear your guys' thoughts. Like, you know, why do you think that is?
Well, I think in the case of Zeb, it's not a character where you're seeing the actor's face, so it doesn't matter whether or not they're a name of note. But when it comes to a character like Ahsoka, whose face you can very clearly see, Rosario Dawson is a much better known name, you know, than sorry, I forget the name of the actress who voices
Ahsoka. Ashley Eckstein.
Ashley Eckstein, yeah. And so, like, even though Ashley Eckstein is always going to be linked to Ahsoka and like that, you know, the character that she originated and that kind of thing, you know, she's not necessarily famous to general audiences who aren't familiar with Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels. So bringing in somebody to play that character and put a famous face alongside it probably makes it a little bit more appealing to general audiences. Whereas when it's an alien character whose face you don't see, it doesn't really matter to them.
I think Filoni has talked about too, where you need to sort of put aside, well, at least when he was talking about this on the panel for the Ahsoka show or the Lucasfilm spotlight at Celebration last year, about how he really needed to cast the people that were right for the role and would be able to give him what he needed in the moment on camera. And to Brad's point, yeah, like Zeb, there's going to be performers there or a tennis ball, you know, or whatever, and Steve Bloom can very much be the voice. But with Ahsoka, yeah, you need someone who can actually act the part in that way. And not to say that I think Ashley Eckstein couldn't do that, but they did very much code Ahsoka as much more ethnic than Ashley Eckstein is capable of. Or in the case of Sabine, I think Tia Sirkar could have probably done that. Why they chose... they didn't choose her and they chose Bo-Katan and Katie Sackhoff. I couldn't tell you other than it seems like there's something in the casting process that they liked about these people that they maybe they didn't find in the others. But Filoni says that it, or at least he said last year, if my memory serves, just that it was a matter of doing what was right for the project rather than just keeping the roles consistent with the actors in media that they didn't start in.
Yeah. And also, who else have they, Hera would probably be.
Yeah. I don't know recast. if they haven't announced who's recast her. I know. I don't think it's Vanessa though. Vanessa Marshall. At least she seems to have sort of,
Isn't rumor that it's,
it's Ewan McGregor's wife.
Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I could totally see that, but yeah, it's interesting who they decided to recast and who they didn't. I guess the only face character that hasn't been recasted was Bo-Katan, right? Everybody else that was like a face character that wasn't like a under a mask or animated was.
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
Yeah. So maybe Katie was just too perfect. I mean, I think she's perfect for that role. So in live action and animated. Okay, anyways, back to this. Cargo walks the Navarro survivors to the lava flats for refuge. And it looks like there's only a fraction of the population of Navarro has survived, although it was a small population anyways, but it seems like a lot less.
Well, I think that was a matter of extras.
Yeah.
Did this give either of you that Lord of the Rings vibe where Theoden is walking everybody to Helm's Deep?
Yes.
I could see that. There's been a lot of Lord of the Rings comparisons this season.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was thinking.
So Teeva found the Mandalorian covert cave, and the Mandalorians are not happy that they have been found. Turns out that R5-D4s helped them find the hidden location. Now, at first I thought this was a possible plot hole, so I wanted to run this by you guys. So R5-D4 was the droid that the Jawas almost sold to Luke Skywalker and the Lars family in A New Hope. But as you might remember, he had a bad motivator, and that led R2-D2 and C-3PO to go home with Luke instead, which led to the Star Wars trilogy that we know and love. Then we saw him in season one of The Mandalorian. Mandalorian finds R5-D4 working in the Mos Eisley Cantina, which to me insinuated that he, R5-D4 has been on Tatooine since we last saw him in A New Hope. He's now found himself in the cantina. You know, someone, he probably got told by the Jawas and now he ended up there. That's an assumption. That's my, whatever. So my question to you guys is, when did R5 help with the rebellion? Because apparently Pelimoto made a comment about R5 being a rebellion fighter earlier in the season, but it doesn't seem like there's any canon evidence to show that R5 was, I mean, there is canon because it's said in this series, obviously. But like, the only thing I can think of is maybe R5 was involved in the rebellion before A New Hope, and then the Jawas scavenged him.
So the rebellion did exist on Tatooine, though, right? After the Empire shows up in A New Hope, they don't go away for the next 3 or 4 years.
They just stayed on Tatooine?
Yeah. They left a garrison there. Because the Empire just continues its reach everywhere. The other thing is like that 3 or 4 years is a long time. And maybe a pilot, picks R5 up, drops him back off. Anything could have happened in those 4 or 5 unaccounted for years.
Brad, do you have any thoughts on this? Do you think R5 was involved in a rebellion during the Star Wars trilogy, before the original Star Wars trilogy? Brian, do you know R5-D4's name?
R5-D4?
Apparently there was this comic book story in 1999.
Skippy the Jedi robot.
Skippy the Jedi droid. You're close enough.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, that was in Star Wars Tales magazine. I want to say issue four or five.
One.
Oh, issue one. Okay. That was a terrific story.
Yeah. So he was Skippy, or actually maybe you tell the story. What was the story?
So it was just a quick story, but it was about Skippy had access to the Force and could see the future. And as the Jawas were selling him to Luke Skywalker, he saw a vision of what the future of the galaxy would be like if he went with Luke. And it ended in just the absolute terror and utter reign of destruction of the Empire taking over everything. And it was awful. And then he saw a vision of the future if R2 went with him and Luke went on his journey and saved the galaxy. So Skippy, the Jedi droid, blew his own motivator in order to make sure that R2-D2 went with Luke to set the galaxy's path correctly.
Wow, what a hero.
Yeah.
Brad, do you believe that droids can have Jedi powers?
No!
Well, there's also... What were you going
to
say?
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say there's that great Visions short where a droid wishes to be a Jedi and sort of taps into that.
Yeah. That's true. There's also Ray Carson short story, The Red One, which was part of From a Certain Point of View, which R2-D2 still attempts to sabotage R5-D4, but relents when the droid wakes up and R2-D2 instead convinces R5-D4 that the fate of the galaxy depends on him to be sold. After R2-D2 mentions he is fighting for the rebellion, R5 decides to sacrifice his own opportunity to be being sold in order to guarantee the success of R2-D2's mission, which leads me to believe, because this is canon, this is part of the new Disney canon.
Well,
leads me to believe maybe he was
questionable.
It's questionable, but yeah, it's from a certain point of view. But maybe he heard, oh, it's for the rebellion, and maybe he previously worked for the rebellion, and maybe that's why he, faked the bad motivator. So that
too
R2
many could... maybes in that sentence.
Okay. Anyways, I still think it's questionable about when R5 actually was part of the rebellion, because it doesn't make much sense to me. But
there's just so much time there where anything could happen, and he could leave Tatooine and come back.
It just seems
it's wide open.
It's wide open. Yes, it could happen. Yes, but it's one of those things that I feel like it makes the universe, the galaxy, smaller to have him part of the rebellion. But sure. Okay. So Din tries to convince the clan of Mandalorians to help rescue Nevarro, and he makes the pitch that if they do, Karga has offered some attractive land on their planet. And then Paz Vizsla makes his speech, and I love how the Mandalorian have to like hold the hammer of the armor to have like the stage. And you wrote an article about that.
I did. There's a long history of talking sticks and ceremonial weapons that denote the right to speak. In the Pacific Northwest, the indigenous tribes have done this for a long time. The first examples of these ceremonial maces and talking sticks date back to, you know, the Stone Age, actually. And, you know, we actually have in the United States a ceremonial mace. The U.S. House of Representatives is unable to conduct business without the mace of the House of Representatives present there as a show of force and decorum from the Speaker of the House and the Sergeant at Arms. And it's funny because they use it in the opposite way, where like, as long as it's there, everybody can speak. But if somebody gets out of line, then they have to present the mace to them. And that's been interesting. And this isn't our first mace either in the U.S. The British came, I don't know if you remember the War of 1812, but they sacked the capital and broke our ceremonial mace. And we were very upset about that. So the one we have now is our replacement after the British ruined ours.
Interesting. I was going to say replacement mace. Like, no, it's almost like if the Darksaber was destroyed and they're like, we're going to make a replacement Darksaber and everybody's going to like follow the leader that has the Darksaber. I don't know. It seems weird.
Yeah. I mean, that's what happens. I mean, in the UK, they've had 12 of them, and they have three currently that they use. And the House of Commons in the UK cannot conduct business unless they have on the table the ceremonial mace that they have that dates back to the reign of Charles II. So it's just like, and they've got 12 of them. So if this one broke, they'd go back to one of the other ones or make a new one. It's just, it's ceremony.
Yeah. Okay. Paz Vizsla makes the case, which we think is going to go one way, but actually please Din's case. And this is the way the Mandalorians make their way to Navarro, which is now in ruins and under the control of the pirate thugs. All of them are like drinking spotchka. My favorite shot is this poor red astromech who is damaged so much that he keeps on bumping into a slab of concrete. Kind of reminds me of like a broken Roomba or something. Just doesn't, the concrete's there. Mandalorian's N1 starfighter attacks Shard's ship, and he responds by sending out some of the pirates in smaller ships. And they have that great scene, which Brad brought up, of the turret pods. Some really cool design. I guess since there's a lot of action here, and we'll break down some of it, but Brad, what are your thoughts on this whole sequence at large?
It's just solid Star Wars action. You know, I love the pirate influence. You know, seeing that N1 starfighter cruise around, is that's such a cool ship. I think that's one of my favorite ships in recent Star Wars memory. It's just, you know, taking something old, you know, giving it a cool kind of like hot rod makeover. And it's just, yeah, it's a great way of using the Star Wars history and refining it in a cool way for this new character. But yeah, just a great collection of action sequences here. You know, we've got the dogfighting in the air, we've got the fight on the ground between the Mandalorians and all the pirates, and it's just good stuff.
Yeah, just so well put together. All three things are happening at the same time. I also like the juxtaposition of the big Shard's huge hunking ship that's like sluggish and slow, and then you have the dogfighting like smaller ships, and to each have an advantage and disadvantage. Brian, what are your thoughts on this whole sequence?
I really liked it. I felt like there was a lot of, I don't know, maybe you two don't have the connection to Attack of the Clones that I did, but in Attack of the Clones, there's that like, fuck yes, like when the Jedi start igniting their sabers around the arena. And I got that same vibe when the Mandalorians just start descending and kicking ass. And then in the sky, Vane can't keep track of them, and he's like, he's above you, no, he's below you, no, he's above you again. Like, they just keep losing them, and like the Mandalorians are just kicking ass the way you would expect Mandalorians to, based on the history and sort of the legends and the reputation that they have in the stories. And it's just like, it makes you, it pumps you up because it's so just cool. And then when the armorer shows up, chef's kiss.
I also love that moment where Amanda lures the pirates to crash into each other. That was great. So everybody's chasing Mando. Bo-Katan drops the clan above the city and they jetpack down. They take out the pirates. My favorite part of this, and actually this whole sequence, is like the cutaways of the Anzellans watching on from their little shop window or door or whatever it is. It all happens just like spectating and like laughing and cheering on. Mando leads the pirates out to the flats while Bo-Katan bombs the huge pirate ship. And I love how the hellish Kwakian monkey lizards even hate the pirates so much that they're willing to give them up to the Mandalorian drop team.
This is one of those moments that's like really foundational in fairy tales. And I mean, it goes back to like the George Lucas. I don't know how much you guys watched that From Star Wars to Jedi documentary, but there's a moment in it where George Lucas is explaining to Richard Marquand and Luke Skywalker that like, it's so important that they meet the Ewoks on their terms, because it's this classic fairy tale idea where it's the magic bunny on the side of the road that you're nice to that gives you the information you need to defeat the evil witch down the road. And you watch the treatment of the Kowakian monkey lizards in the first episodes, and they're literally like captured, sold as food, run up on Spitz. And then when we see Navarro again at the beginning of this season, they're happy, they're left alone, and they're treated nicely. And the pirates are start shooting at them. So they fill in that sort of mythical idea. And I'm realizing I've taken this on a way ridiculous detour for something that's such a throwaway moment, but it's so foundationally Star Wars that it feels right, if that makes sense.
No, it definitely makes sense. You know, there's a moment where the Mandalorians find themselves pinned in a corner, taking fire from all sides. The armorer uses her forging tools to take out the pirate stationed in the magistrate office. And then you have the Mandalorians advance and they're able to take back the city. And a few of the pirates try to escape, and they're met with returning citizens led by Karga. And my one criticism, if I have any criticism of this whole action sequence, it is that the Navarro people kind of like could have participated more. They were kind of like the helpless people out in the desert, and they just showed up at the very end to like scare off the scragglers from trying to escape. But it's no big deal. Sometimes you need helpless people to fight for, if that makes sense. Not everybody needs to be a hero. One of my favorite shots is one of the Mandalorians surfing on the back of one of those pirate ships before jetpacking off it, before it crashes to the ground. And Vane decides to abandon Shard as it all seems to be lost. Shard takes the helm and takes a last stand, but Mando takes out the ship's last remaining engine, and the ship dives into the lava hell behind the city, and just this cool looking explosion, which apparently is far enough away that it doesn't cause any destruction in the city center, but whatever.
Of course.
Yeah. Everyone celebrates, but most importantly, the Inzelans celebrate. And Greef Karga makes a speech offering the Mandalorian all the land from the Western Lava Flats to the Bullock Canyon. To the people of Mandalore, you may no longer have your home planet, but you now have a home. And Brian, you brought up a fun, cool little Easter egg here.
Yeah, Bullock Canyon seems to be named after Jeremy Bullock, who originated the role of Boba Fett in Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. He's one of the nicest guys in the world, if ever you met him on the con circuit, and he passed away in 2020. I'm sure he would have been touched by this little in-universe nod to him.
Very cool. Okay, so the armorer requests presence with Bo-Katan in the former Mandalorian covert beneath the sewers of the city. And the armorer reminisces about the Great Forge on Mandalore, which was huge, and apparently you could hear the sound of 100 hammers. I wonder if we'll ever get to see this on Mandalore. Maybe we'll see. The armorer makes the forges. It makes an analogy about the forges, the difference of how they're very different, but in the end, it's the same purpose. And she asks Bo to remove her helmet. Brad, what did you think was going on when this moment came? Because I was like very confused.
Yeah, I initially thought that. The armorer was trying to pull one over on Bo-Katan and like trying to trick her into removing her helmet and being like, nope, you're banished. Get the hell out of here.
That's what I thought too.
That's where I was on that. Like, I think that was a really, really well-conceived rug pull.
Yeah, no, I agree. So the armorer says that the Mandalorian people have strayed away from the way, and that all Mandalorians must walk the way together. This is like a rug pull in many senses, because I think we were all on the same page that we thought that this sect of Mandalorians were going to be revealed to be kind of a cult, and we were going to learn that the way was not actually the way. Like, we've talked about that in the past, like, but it seems like that's not the case. It seems like the cult is doing a face turn here.
Yeah, I was very surprised to hear the armorer come to Bo-Katan and say that, like, she's the one that needs to unite both sects of Mandalore, as opposed to being, you know, combative and confrontational, trying to stop her from changing their ways.
Well, I think part of it is exposure, right? Like, this is something that happens when any religious sect actually starts accepting outside ideas and people from around, like, they start liberalizing their views, right? And so them, like, Din being an example of, like, I've been exposed, I've seen all these people, I've seen all these different types of Mandalorians, and here's one of them, and I'm bringing her to you. And they get to know her, and she is more adamant. Like what Paz Vizsla says, like, Bo-Katan didn't give up on my son when the rest of us did. So I think that they're seeing the proof is in the pudding, and that even if she takes her helmet off, she has the spirit of a Mandalorian, and it's changed their minds. Just that exposure, that pluralism that they're experiencing.
So the Armorer now believes that Bo-Katan has seen the Mythosaur and believes it's a sign that the next age is upon us and that the Mandalorian must come together. Since Bo has walked both worlds, she believes that she will be the one to reunite them, to unite them. There's a couple things here. This is weird because I feel like last week when we were talking about this and when Bo-Katan brought up the Mythosaur to the Armorer, we were all kind of on the same page of it didn't seem like the Armorer was, like, believed it. Like, there was even these memes online, like the meme of, like, the Sure Grandma meme where, like, they put the text over the woman helping her grandma being like, I saw a Mythosaur or whatever, and it's like, Sure Grandma, or other way around, but you know what I'm saying. So what do you think has changed since when last week when she told her, and now, because it didn't seem like she had much reaction then?
I think time passing has helped for sure. I don't know, like, I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong or misremembering, but I felt like I had read that as though it could be either way when we talked about it last
week.
You did,
yeah.
And I think, you know, we figured it out. Now it's been revealed how she really, really took that. Why wouldn't she take Bo-Katan's word for it? And I imagine it has a lot to do with the fact that Bo-Katan, again, right? She's the one making the plans. She's the one actually doing the leading. The Armorer didn't come up with the plan. It's very carefully Bo-Katan who's doing that, right? When they take back Navarro, and it works, and they don't really lose anybody, right?
Yeah, no, I accept all of that. I think this is one of the rare exceptions in this show where the mask being over the actress's face maybe created confusion in how we're accepting what she felt in that moment, if that makes sense. I feel like it was hard to relay a reaction to it.
Yeah, which just goes to prove the point that maybe they should take their masks off more often.
Do you think now that some of these Mandalorians are allowed to remove their helmet that this will lead the way for even part of the sect of Mandalorians to remove their helmets?
I don't know. I mean, like, maybe that's a bridge too far for some of them. Some of these people, like Paz Vizsla, I doubt he would choose that. I doubt Din Djarin would choose that, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think, but I feel like they're going to find ways where they can do that more and feel a little bit more loose with it than needing to go back to Mandalore and bathe in the living waters. Or maybe she's just counting on the fact that, like, oh, we'll take our helmets off, we'll take a break for a day, we'll go bathe in the living waters, it's all good. Because they're going to take back Mandalore.
I will say, if they changed the rule, and I was Mando, I'd be pissed. Because I'd be like, I went all the way to Mandalore. I risked my life to bathe in those waters, and now you're changing the rule? I could have just, like, stayed away from them. I don't know. Anyways, so the Armorer walks Bo-Katan out without her helmet on, and everybody's like, WTF. And she explains that Bo will bring more exiled Mandalorians back. At first, Paz Vizsla questions it, but Bo, especially her not wearing the helmet, but seems to easily accept the explanation. It's a really powerful moment. I kind of felt like this was going to be the end of the episode because it kind of, like, the music kind of built in a way. I almost think that this probably was the original end of the episode, and then they moved this other thing further forward, I mean back. What do you guys think?
I think the sting, the the question raised by the end of this is a stronger question than is what is raised by the Bo-Katan story. So I kind of feel like I did feel that same way, but I felt like that was a purposeful cut to black. Wait, there's one more scene, right? Like, I felt like that was very purposeful rather than moved from elsewhere.
Yeah. It almost felt like it was an end credit scene or something. So the scene I'm talking about is Teeva discovering an abandoned attacked Lambda class shuttle out in space. He radios to Lieutenant Reed. We've actually seen Lieutenant Reed before in the Book of Boba Fett. He's a lieutenant in the New Republic, and he's played by Max Lloyd-Jones, who reprises his role here, who is also the person who played Luke Skywalker in the finale of last season. So there's a record of a missing craft in the region, but the details are classified. He launches a probe into the wreckage, and it's confirmed to be the New Republic prison transport transporting Moff Gideon. He never made it to trial, turns out. Everything's been confirmed here. When trying to find out who perpetrated this prison break, the probe finds a fragment of Beskar alloy in the side of the ship. And the Lieutenant Reed asks if this means the Mandalorian broke him out. Cut to black. And there's some questions here. Actually, before we get into the questions and speculation, Brad, what did you think of this final scene?
It's intriguing. I'm not necessarily sure if I buy that it's real or if it's something that has been set up to be discovered so that Gideon can stop the various sects of Mandalorians from uniting and reclaiming Mandalore, which is something I'm sure he would be very happy to stop and avoid having to deal with. But then I also do wonder if there is, you know, another team of Mandalorians out there who have maybe, you know, gone rogue and taken a darker path and are working with the Empire now. You know, who knows? That's, you know, survival in the galaxy can be, you know, a big, you know, struggle. And, you know, maybe some Mandalorians are just doing what they have to get by.
So before we hear from Brian and myself, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. We're into speculation. Brian, I think you have something to say with this. What does the Beskar alloy mean? Were the Mandalorians involved?
So I think Brad's theory is actually a really solid theory that this is Moff Gideon possibly just trying to sow discord among things. But there's also another possibility in that. Well, there's two other possibilities that could make very interesting narrative sense. One is that, and this is, I think, the less likely version, is that Bo-Katan's Mandos that took off to be mercenaries after she didn't get the Darksaber back got paid to do this. And I think that that's a logical possibility tying some of these threads together. The other thing is that there is an entire group of Mandalorians that were those Imperial Super Commandos that were loyal to the Empire. And they did not care for any of the other sects, and they cared about what the Empire was doing and how they were working with them for greater power. Gar Saxon and his, you know, cadres of people, his troops and the people loyal to him, were deposed by Bo-Katan. And so there is another competing sect or a number of sects out there trying to subvert Bo-Katan and that unification in other ways. And it could be them. And I could very easily see them continuing to be in league with Moff Gideon.
For sure. But also there's also the possibility that there are some Mandalorians out there who want Moff Gideon to answer for the Great Purge of Mandalore.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility too.
I don't think that's what's going to end up. I think it's exactly what Brad's saying, that they are trying to frame the Mandalorians in some way, or maybe they're trying to, maybe it's both of what you guys said. They're trying to frame the Mandalorians and they used a sect of Mandalorians to do it, to frame them, which I guess doesn't frame them if they're actually the Mandalorians, but you know what I'm saying? They're trying to frame Din and his sect by using Mandalorians, frame other Mandalorians.
My favorite thing about this scene, though, was the two really cool, like, movie references that it drops.
Okay, what movie references?
So I think there's an element of Jaws to it, right? Where that slice of Beskar is a shark tooth in Ben Garner's boat, right? This is, it has that look, especially when you have the hole in the ship that the probe is able to go into. It feels very much like the hole that Brody is going into or looking into when Ben Garner's face pops in there. And there is a little bit of a jump scare, at least on Tava's part, when he's watching on the monitor and sees that body floating there. The other one is Aliens. When he sends the probe in, the droid's piece, which is something we haven't seen a droid do before in that way, which was really cool. It has those blue thin scan lines that match the opening of Alien when Ripley's pod is found by the scavenger team. And they send their robot in to do those cool scans of the dead ship, and they come across Ripley in her hypersleep pod. So I thought it was really cool to see those two things sort of mashed together in a really interesting way, that I was that Leonardo DiCaprio pointing meme the whole time, going like, oh, this is Jaws, this is Aliens. I loved it.
Yeah. It's almost a very like James Cameron like shot. Like that.
I mean,
whole...
it's 100%.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
They matched the angle too. So actually you see that angle where the scanner swipes the lens the same way James Cameron staged it in Aliens.
Okay. So the question here, guys, is who broke Gideon out and what do they want with him? Brad, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it's obviously, you know, a remnant of the Empire, you know, and I'm still of the mind that Thrawn is probably the one who is pulling the strings here. It makes the most sense if we're going to be heading into Ahsoka soon and his name has already been dropped and we know that he's out there. It seems like he's the only villain who could have, you know, the resources to pull off something like this, you know, which is a pretty big deal. And I feel like that's the thing that makes the most sense.
And Thrawn is the sort of villain who would plant evidence to get his enemies fighting amongst each other.
Yeah, he's always like three chess moves ahead. I just wonder if Thrawn is going to be the big reveal in the finale of this season, which it could very well be. I wonder if general Star Wars audiences that don't watch the animated stuff or read the books, how that's going to play for them.
I feel like there's this saturation of knowledge of Thrawn. You're hard pressed to find a person. Like, I've talked to people who are those very casual Star Wars fans who seem to know Thrawn just because they existed in the 90s. Right.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think there's a lot of people too, that when Ahsoka mentioned the name of Thrawn in Mando season 2, a lot of people started looking into him. And they've been sowing the seeds long enough for you to read those 6 books in the current canon and watch Rebels, that by the time we get to him, it's going to make a lot of sense. I think that's one thing that Disney's finding, is that people are watching they're going back and watching the animated shows for context in the live action shows.
Yeah, but they didn't bother to put on the Jedi Chronicles, or wait, what was that? Jedi Temple Challenge.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if there's a licensing issue there too, because that was, I feel like it got sponsored specifically for YouTube by, like, it got paid for by an advertiser, I think.
Yeah, and it's not even on the Star Wars YouTube channel. It's on the Star Wars Kids YouTube channel. It's kind of, not easy to find. I mean, it is easy to find. You can go to YouTube and find it, but it's not like, you know, on the main channels. I agree with that. A new home on Navarro sounds nice, but it seems like they are already want to take back Mandalorian. So what was the point of even them getting this new home on Navarro?
I don't know. That's the other funny thing, is when she's like, we're taking back Mandalore. And I'm like, from who? There's no one there.
Ah, there's those mutants there.
Well,
yeah, okay. But those mutants were always there.
Yeah, but now there's more of them. And
I guess now.
And they're feral. And obviously when they were there, that there's, you know.
Okay, well, here's something
I
want to bring up.
Okay, go ahead and bring that up. But I've got to, I actually solved my own problem in my head. So go ahead.
Oh, no, answer your problem then.
I mean, that huge Imperial contingent that blew up Bo-Katan's castle on Kalevala, they're probably assuming that there's something on Mandalore that's worth the whatever Imperial remnant is there. And where better than to hide that massive Imperial remnant than a planet that everyone thinks is cursed and dead and no one would be visiting on under normal circumstances anyway?
That is so maybe, the theory that is going around online, is that the Imperial resurgence is held up. They have a base on Mandalore. That would explain why the Empire lied about the planet's fate, how it's inhabitable. It's also have been established that there's electromagnetic fluctuations that would prevent anything from being detected. So I wanted to ask you guys your thoughts on that, but you came to that conclusion by yourself without even reading any internet theories.
Yeah, there you go.
Brad, what do you think of that theory?
No, I like that, actually, and I didn't get around to it in time, but I was going to mention the fact that they were attacked by TIE fighters shortly after they were on Mandalore, and it's probably standard reason that it's because they were on Mandalore, and the Empire is like, no, get away from here.
Okay, will Bo-Katan unite all the Mandalorians? I feel like they're building her up to be the savior. The Book of Boba Fett, the armorer said, the songs of eons past were told of the Mythosaur rising up to herald the new age of Mandalore. I think it was assumed at that time that Din might be the one to ride the Mythosaur, and or maybe Din was the Mythosaur because he has the, I don't know. But what does this mean? Do you think Bo-Katan is going to be the leader? Because she still seems, I don't know, is... She tends to not get along with everybody. Can she keep it together to be the leader?
I think she's learning, and I think that that's the point. And I feel like she kind of has to, because I don't think Din wants that job, and he seems like the only other person who could do it. You know, it would seem odd if they did this all just to keep the status quo of the armorer leading everybody. So I think that this is what has to happen.
But then you have the problem that you brought up earlier, Brad, that the Mandalorian is becoming a supporting character in his own show.
Unless this is all to place all of these Mandalorians on Mandalore, and then he feels dejected because he has to lose or give up the Darksaber or whatever, and then goes on his other quest and takes off again. And so this is just setting Mandalore up for future storytelling and send him on his way for his next adventure.
Yeah.
Well, you also bring up the Darksaber. What does this mean for the Darksaber? Because I thought the person that leads Mandalore is the person that has the Darksaber. But what if one person rides the Mythosaur and then there's one person that has the Darksaber and they're two separate people? Who leads the Mandalorian people?
Maybe we'll run into a thing where maybe it'll be the armor and Bo-Katan who lead, the people.
I guess we already talked about Zeb and what role we think he's going to play in the future Mandalorian shows. We just all assume that he's going to be in Ahsoka, right?
Yeah, it makes the most sense. Yeah.
Okay, if Gorian Shard was trying to take over Nevarro for something more than just revenge, what do you think that plan was?
There was something there on Nevarro in that Imperial base that they blew up. That Moff Gideon might still want. I mean, it was an advanced science division facility. We know that. We saw the cloning canisters and stuff before that stuff was destroyed. But what if that's not the only installation? Or what if all of that's not completely destroyed? Because it seems like Aaliyah Kane is working really hard to keep everybody's mouth shut about what's going on with Gideon. Enough to mind flay Dr. Pershing, right? Like, it seems like as soon as she saw somebody who had any connection to Nevarro, she went in and was trying to divert everybody's attention away from it.
Yeah. What is G68 doing here? What is her plan? She's obviously... She's obviously up to no good in the New Republic. She's working. We all agree she's working for the Imperial resurgence, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, no, yeah. She's taking orders from Gideon still.
Hmm. What do you think? So you think that she's just communicating to, she's just like an inside man trying to divert them wherever they don't want them to go, kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's actually an inverse of what we're seeing in Andor.
Yeah.
Right. With Luthen Rael's contact inside of the ISB. She's the Imperial counterpart to that inside Republic requisitions.
Have we seen the last of Vane?
No, I think they sent him off to purposely bring him back in some way or another.
Do we have any other speculation, any other theories, anything else left to say about this episode?
I hope we get more pirate tunes.
More pirate tunes.
Well, we got the main theme in that pirate. I just loved how much they leaned into the piracy and the like Pirates of the Caribbean pirates, like giving him the Long John Silver voice, giving the Ugnaught the Mr. Smee costume. Like, I was just delighted by all of that.
Brad, any last thoughts?
I hope that they have some of these pirates show up in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Why don't they just remake, instead of trying to do another Pirates of the Caribbean, why not just do Pirates of the Caribbean in Star Wars universe?
Just do Space Pirates of the Caribbean.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay, anyways, you can find more of all of our work at slashfilm.com. You can find this podcast on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please send us your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, theories, speculation to peter@slashfilm.com. And please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends. Spread the word. We'll see you tomorrow.